I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
If you enjoy listening to the LRB podcast, then you'll probably enjoy reading the LRB. You can subscribe to the LRB from just £1 per issue. To find out more, go to lrb.me/listen. That's lrb.me/listen. Or click on the link in the description below this episode.
Hello and welcome to the London Review of Books podcast. I'm Joanne O'Leary, an editor at the paper, and I'm joined today by one of our longest standing contributors, David Trotter, whose piece in the latest issue is about the writer Elizabeth Bowen. It's a review of a selection of Bowen's stories edited by Tessa Hadley and published by Vintage, and of two of her novels, The Hotel from 1927 and Friends and Relations from 1931, both recently reissued by Anchor. Hi, David. Thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Hello.
The piece is really a consideration of Bowen's work as a whole. It teases out the various complexities and contradictions that distinguished her life in fiction, her relationship with Ireland and its colonial legacy, her fixation on dysfunctional family dynamics, and her very distinctive and at times obtuse style. We'll go on to talk about these issues in detail, but let's begin by talking a little bit about her background. So Bowen was born in 1899 into a wealthy Anglo-Irish family. Her ancestors had come to Ireland with Cromwell in 1649, and in the 1770s built Bowen Court, a large country house on a vast estate in North Cork, which Bowen then inherited on her father's death in 1930. The Anglo-Irish big house, which in her own words was ignobly got, stands at the centre of her imagination, David. Could you say a little bit more about her background and how her status within the Protestant ascendancy influenced her work?
Well, it's certainly a most unusual background, because I mean, not many modern writers can claim to have inherited a genuine stately pile as she did. And of course, it was, as you've been suggesting, a stately pile freighted with political controversy. And I think what's interesting in a way is her preparedness to address that inheritance and that controversy directly, and most notably in Bowen's Court, which is a book she published in 1944, which is a remarkable account of her family's occupancy of this house in North Cork since the very beginnings. But it's also a history of the rise and fall of the Anglo-Irish ruling class. And I think she was a true believer in the tradition of Edmund Burke in the civilizing mission of the big house in its area, but also in the country more generally. But this was for her, from the very outset, a troubled inheritance. It's a troubled birthright, because in the winter of 1906, when she was seven, her father suffered the latest in a series of breakdowns and had himself certified. And she and her mother went to live in England on the Kent coast. Although her father eventually recovered, she never really got back home to Bowen's Court or to Ireland, really, in that sense. She never fully settled either in England or in Ireland. And Seán Ó Fhéilín, the Irish writer who got to know her in the late 1930s and indeed became her lover, I think he really put his finger on it, because he said that she felt herself to be a resident alien in both countries, in both Ireland and England. And I think that's a very good way of putting it. And that sense of rootlessness, of never quite belonging anywhere, certainly got into her fiction. And it may be part of the reason for the appeal of that fiction today.
Seán Ó Fhéilín, I should say, for our listeners, also in an inspired act of commissioning as her ex-lover, wrote a piece for the LRB on Bowen in 1982. And he talks about her split-mindedness, the cloven-hearted nature of her character and her work, I suppose. And David, in the piece, you talk a lot about the difference between heredity and environment, this binary that Bowen establishes. She talks about her work in relation to her life. Could you say a little bit about that, maybe?
Yes, certainly. I think that it might be important just to note, first of all, that, I mean, Ó Fhéilín is an extraordinarily interesting witness, because he was a militant Republican who fought against the British in the War of Independence in 1920. And it was IRA policy to clear the Anglo-Irish gentry out of the country by burning their houses down. And a lot of houses in North Cork were burned down, but not Bowen's Court. So why was that? And there's a very interesting footnote in the part of Bowen's Court when she comes to talk about this episode, where she just says, "I cannot go into this. I cannot go into this." And that's pretty high in the annals of gnomic utterance. Mm-hmm. Why was it, and why couldn't she go into it? And I mean, it seems that the Bowen scholar Neil Corcoran was making a program about her in the late 1990s, and he interviewed people in the area, and they said that the local branch of the IRA, some of whose members were working in the house or had worked in the house, held a meeting in the house itself, at which it was decided that they weren't actually going to burn it down. So, and her father had warned her that they might burn it down. So it's an extraordinary episode, really. We still don't know what happened. And that fed into her fiction and fed into her second novel she wrote, The Last September, which is set in a big house modelled very clearly on Bowen's Court. And it's actually a kind of brave decision to write about recent history. She said it was a novel with the texture of history. And it was very brave to write about controversial recent history in which her family was so central. But that's an attempt to kind of work through, I mean, the gravity of her inheritance. So there is a lot there in terms of heredity and everything associated with Bowen's Court and the politics of Bowen's Court was her heredity. But then, as you say, she moved to England, and something else happened then, which was in September 1912, when she would have been, I guess, 13. Her mother died of cancer. And at that point, so there was a kind of double dislocation, move from Ireland to England, and then from a nuclear family, mother, father, daughter, imperfect, but still a nuclear family, to really, she was then looked after by a kind of a team of distant relatives, what her biographer, Victoria Glendinning, calls a battery of aunts. So there was this further displacement or dislocation, which involves being looked after these strange people. So that's when the cleft between heredity and environment emerges. So heredity was really Bowen's Court and all that and the values associated with it. Environment was basically having to deal with whatever outlandish situation you happen to find yourself in. And it was really that. It was environment, I think, that made her a writer, because it was the outlandish situations that fired her imagination. And that's what happens. I mean, you know, as you know yourself, when you're reading the novels, you spend the first chapters struggling to work out who everyone is and what they can possibly be doing there. And the answer to that is usually that they're an aunt or an uncle or a cousin of some kind. And cousins are absolutely indispensable in Berlin. You couldn't do anything at all without them. And it was inevitable, I think, that she would actually come to write a novel called Friends and Relations. Because what you really like to do was to bring together people who are neither wholly friends nor wholly relations and see what happened.
Yes, and you begin the piece with a very striking observation that there are more weird households in Bowen's novels than in any other comparable writer. And perhaps given her own family background, it's sort of understandable that she's fixated on these unorthodox family dynamics. But what is it about cousins in particular that interests her, do you think? Why cousinhood, and why does she, you know, explore this at such length in her work?
I don't know. I think cousins are perfectly placed between friend and relation. You know, they are the kind of, you know, there's familiarity and there's distance. They are technically families, as we all know, but they're rather strange creatures who drift in and out and come attached to some other kind of set of people, and you never quite know what to make of them. But by that very fact, of course, they are exciting and dangerous, perhaps even in ways that the closer relations aren't. So I think she was always looking for that perfect kind of spot, the sweet spot, if you like, between a relation and a friend. And that's where all the energy, all the kind of dynamics of her stories take place, in that kind of area.
There's another line from the piece I wanted to pick up here. The weird household is an assault course in atmosphere. And you talk quite a lot about atmosphere in the piece. You mentioned Bowen's annoyance that people didn't discuss the where of her writing, that they tended to focus on the symbolism or the psychology. But one of the things you then go on to argue very persuasively is that place doesn't loom large in her work, at least in the way that she perhaps wanted. Partly because, and I'm quoting from your piece here, her fiction's uniqueness lies in its versatile modern understanding of place as an inner landscape. So there's a twinning in the work, if you like, between the outer worlds and a character's mental state. Could you talk a little bit about that and how you see atmosphere working, I suppose?
Yes, well, she wasn't a regional novelist. I mean, the Bowen's North Cork is not a mythical terrain like Hardy's Wessex, which exists independently of the characters and indeed sometimes entirely overshadows them. And what she was interested in instead was what she called place feeling. That's to say, the relation of a particular person to a particular place, a particular moment in time. And I think the best way to think about that is to say that she dealt in atmosphere, because atmosphere is inside us, but it's also around us. And atmosphere is what a person makes of a place while in the process being, in some sense, made by it. It's a mood. It's something we create by the way we happen to be feeling. But it's also a milieu. It's an environment shaped by forces beyond our control. It's, I mean, just to pick on some of the terms that she herself uses, it's a habitat, or it's a climate even. So it's these much larger, all-enveloping frames of reference, as well as something incredibly intimate. And I think that's why she spent so much time really trying to think about and to develop atmospheres in our fiction, because she wanted to capture, the kind of the intensity of the interactions we have with the world.
And, you know, you quote the bit from Bowen herself, who talks about amorphousness being a kind of fundamental condition of human experience, and that prompts us to kind of obsessively wish to acquire outline, to take shape, to be unmistakably demarcated. And I'm struck that the characters in her novels always seem to come into focus through a careful description, not of the characters themselves, but of their surroundings. So there's a strange sense in which we see the characters better by looking at something else. And that's kind of how atmosphere seems to work.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, it's that sense of a kind of a beginning or an opening onto a world. It's quite hard to characterise exactly what happens, but that we do start immediately with a person already in a place, or not necessarily already in a place, in fact, because that's, I mean, her fiction consists so much of arrivals and departures. And I think perhaps that's where, speaking of that sort of modern or versatile sense of place, what I mean by that is that the place is as much a matter of arrival and departure That's to say of anticipation, and then of a kind of decompression as you leave it, as all the atmosphere deflates. And it's very much a matter of as much of what we create as of any kind of more settled or traditional notion of place. And that goes back very much, as I think we were saying earlier, to her kind of sense of ruthlessness. She was always arriving at places, and you get this intense opening of a scene as she arrives at the place. And I always like it that the novel she was writing, the fragment of the novel she was writing when she died, and it's called The Driveway. It's you know, the whole of this scene is set on the approach to one of these kind of big houses. So it's really, it's the idea that the place is created as much in anticipation and in memory as it is in experience that makes her modern, I think.
And you get that sense of, you know, she always felt this lack quite intensely, and that the kind of almost glutted surface of the work, it's so richly descriptive, is almost that compensation. It's providing or filling in that kind of,
yes,
that gap, or the outline is being filled in all the time.
And I think I think that she felt herself, both in her life and in her vision, that when you are in a kind of an environment, or an inhospitable environment, if you're in one of these kind of outlandish situations, I mean, there is something kind of Darwinian about her fiction and about her approach, you know, that you have to sink or swim, she says. You have to adapt to an often hostile environment. And one of the ways in which she did that herself was to perform. And I always like, there's another wonderful little comment by O'Phelan about her, the way she was with friends, the way she was in you know, socially, as it were, which is that he talked about it as dressage. So I can just imagine her sort of, you know, in Olympic style, taking her horse across the arena, dressage. But he also said that there was this kind of other side to her, that she was farouche, that she was wild, so that the dressage would be interrupted every now and then by something much more dramatic and wild. But this idea of you perform in order to survive, I think, and that's what, as you know, as you were saying about the amorphousness that she endows her characters with. Well, they have to perform in order to survive, and that's, they have to sink or swim.
Yes, and I mean, Wolfe was quite, she knew Wolfe quite well, but Wolfe was quite rude about that performativity in person, wasn't she? She describes her as a very honourable, horse-faced, upper-class, hard, constricted mind. But that sense of striving to kind of occupy a personality, it comes across quite strongly in the fiction too. I wonder, David, if it would be interesting to read a little bit from one of the novels, perhaps, just to give people a sense of what we're talking about here when we're discussing the atmosphere in the work, because it really is quite unique.
Yes, yeah, well, I think that's right. I mean, I just to say, and I'll probably come back to this, but I mean, that Wolfe was such a dominant presence, and so that a kind of, you know, an audience with Virginia was the kind of was initiation rite for all sorts of young writers, and I think that particularly young women writers. But I think the passage we might read was from The Heat of the Day, Second World War novel, which is published in 1948. It's set mostly in London, but it does involve a couple of expeditions to Ireland. And one of these expeditions, the heroine Stella Rodney arrives at Mount Morris, which is another of these kind of Anglo-Irish big houses, which her son Roderick has just inherited inevitably from his father's cousins indispensable as ever. And I mean, she's been there before. In fact, it was the house in which Rodney was conceived. And the caretaker's daughter, Mary, is conducting her upstairs to her bedroom in near total darkness. And to me, this is absolutely echt Bowen atmosphere. Indeed, the familiarity of the house was startling. As a whole, it rose to the surface in her, as though something weighting it to the bottom had let go. Expectancy rather than memory from now on guided her. She could not tell at which moment of her return journey the sensory train had started itself alight. Now she seemed to perceive on all sides round her, and with a phantasmagoric clearness, everything that for the eye the darkness hid. The declivities and the treads of the staircase, the rounded glimmer of its Venetian window, ever wholly extinguished only by blackest night. The creak of the lobby flooring under the foot, and the sifted near and farness of smells of plaster, pelts, wax, smoke, weathered woodwork, oiled locks, and outdoor trees preceded themselves in her as she followed Mary. Knowledge of all this must have been carried in her throughout the years, which in these minutes fell away. So, extraordinary sense of the reappearance of memory as expectancy. So this atmosphere, this place feeling, is a feeling at once about the past or a thought about the past and a feeling or a thought about the future at the same time. Memory become expectancy. And that's, I think, is an extraordinary example of her conjuring of atmosphere.
Mm. And these moments when she's describing the big house, particularly in her fiction, the way in which time sort of collapses is also quite interesting. And you have that incredibly kind of rich historical text where you're talking about memory, but it's sort of unfolding through this exterior objective sort of description. And it works in quite an unusual way. I mean, it's different to somebody like Woolf, who's writing from inside a consciousness. I mean, how do you rate them, or how do you, are they similar to one another? Are they not? What do you kind of make of that?
Yeah, well, I think that's, yes, a very important question because of Woolf's kind of extraordinary dominance, really. And I think that there were a number of younger women writers making their way in the interwar years who were very conscious of the shadow she cast and did, as you've just suggested, did think of her very much in terms of someone whose emphasis was on personal consciousness, the atoms falling on the mind, as she put it, and that's what she was trying to capture. And I think that the whole emphasis on place feeling in Bowen, but also in other writers, and in atmosphere, in environment, this rather Darwinian taste to some of Bowen's fiction, that all of that was in part a way to maneuver out from beneath Woolf's shadow. And of course, what they thought about Woolf, or what Bowen rather thought about Woolf, was what she most admired in her was something that we would perhaps call her modernism, but which Bowen called a savage intractability of the spirit which must experiment, the savage intractability of the spirit which must experiment. So that was Woolf, must experiment. And I think that Bowen was a great stylist. I mean, that the passage I've just read, it slows you down. You have to pick your way along the sentences. And that slowing down is a very important effect. It's what really creates the atmosphere, if you like, as you're going along. And I think the thing about, that she didn't want to experiment. What Bowen wanted to do was to spring surprises. And I think that's the great thing about her fiction, the way she springs her surprises, that her modernism was a kind of stealth technology. You know, it's come and gone before you know it's there. And so she, her idiosyncrasies, of grammar and syntax and idiom they're not an authorial signature. They're not a kind of calling card. They're there for a particular narrative purpose.
I wanted to ask a little bit about how we situate Bowen, because as you see in the piece, there is a kind of clear attachment to the trappings of the realist novel. And then this kind of grammatical, syntactical, idiomatic peculiarity and her neologisms. And she, of course, she's funny because she disliked Joy. She thought, you know, he reduced everything to jelly in the effort to try to explain what he found funny to the reader, but she did admire Woolf. And is she a modernist writer? I mean you're suggesting, I suppose, that she's playing with it in her own way, but there is something much more traditional about her approach to it too. She didn't want things to fall apart in some way. I mean, it's almost cinematic. I guess one of the things, the famous thing about modernism, is you can't really make films about any of the kind of great modernist novels. They don't quite work cinematically. They're too fractured and there's too much interior consciousness. But of course, Bowen, it's so cinematic. As you're reading the passages, it sort of slows you down and you see everything very, very clearly. But trying to think about her in terms of a tradition is quite difficult, I think.
Yes. I mean, I would say that, you know, she never really kind of presented herself as a modernist or thought of herself in those terms. That wasn't her entry into the marketplace, and that she would quite happily have thought of herself as being in the tradition of British domestic fiction from Jane Austen all the way through to the early E.M. Forster. And those were both writers she admired intensely. She said that as a teenager, she had saturated herself in Forster's novels. And Forster, of course, was precisely the writer who was being outflanked by the modernists, by Joyce and by Virginia Woolf in the 1920s as this different alternative model appeared. And I think what I'd say about Byrne is that Woolf's description of her mind as constricted is certainly very unfair. And okay, she didn't want to write like Woolf, she didn't want to write like Joyce, but she did actually quite enjoy Finnegan's Wake because she thought that Joyce had had so much fun in inventing his own universal language that she just liked his kind of the pleasure he took in it. But for her, the aim was to actually work within the conventions of, I suppose we would say, domestic realism, but then to spring her surprises. And so that's, I think, really where those idiosyncrasies come into play, that these kind of disturbances, if you like, of the dressage of the prose style with its wonderful kind of elegant gait, its wonderful rhythms. But then they are kind of interrupted, or I think we feel that they're interrupted by the occasional eruption of one of these idiosyncrasies. And we could actually look at one if you think that would be a good idea.
Yeah, that would be great.
My favorite I really like is that her triple negatives. I mean, I can't think of any other writer either then or perhaps subsequently who was kind of fond of triple negatives. And following these triple negatives, it is a bit like, you know, being a hamster on its wheel that you spin round and round. And I think the one I like most is actually in the Last September, which the novel, you know, set in an Irish big house, Daniel's Town, which is also based on very much on Byrne's court. And what happens is this this particular idiosyncrasy signals the end of a kind of violent flirtation between Hugo Montmorency, who's an old friend of the Daniel's Town family and is staying with his wife over the summer, and this extraordinary explosive woman, Marda Norton, who arrives in the middle section of the novel and causes an immense stirs up the atmosphere no end. And having stirred too hard, as it were, she leaves abruptly, thus denying Hugo a dramatically reproachful farewell, which is what he'd really been hoping for. So this is just a little passage when he's failing to say his dramatic farewell. Marda turned half away from them, tapped a tune on the edge of the mantelpiece, laughed at every shade of a silence, and felt how resolutely Hugo did not look at her now. There was to be no opportunity for what he must not say to be rather painfully not said. And that's the bit I love. And that's the surprise that's been sprung here and tells us that this particular atmosphere created by the flirtation throughout the whole of the middle section of the novel has really come to an end. So there's something Hugo must not say to Marda. He would like the opportunity not to say it, but he's denied even that. And that's what it feels like to have an atmosphere broken or to disappear from an atmosphere, as it were. And I think what other writer can you think of who would have actually slipped that in, as it were, in her kind of rather sly but incredibly effective way?
And for all her resistance to psychology and things like that, of course, you know, you feel it with him. It's perfectly enacted in this very crisp but kind of complicated sentence. And you go back into his mind and into all of that negativity, and it's kind of redoubles and triples, and that's kind of how she does it, and it's really extraordinary.
Well, it's a frequent experience in reading her novels. You think, whoa, what happened there? Has she been just been dumped? Has he just been dumped? And you realise that, and of course, what she's capturing there is also the pain of that experience. I mean, there is a kind of, despite all the dressage, there's a kind of rawness of feeling in these novels. And very often it comes, when an atmosphere has, as it were, collapsed in on itself, as happens here.
Yes, and it's also quite funny. I mean, she's a very funny writer, and there's an enormous amount of satire there. And the way in which she manages to weave that through this quite ornate and almost decorous style is really impressive. I mean, I was struck looking at some of the criticism by how much stick she got really for her kind of high-flown vocabulary and for these I mean, in modernist terms, we would call them very small transgressions compared to, you know, somebody like Wilfred Joyce. And, you know, people insisting that you had to read sentences several times and that, you know, she was incredibly difficult and isn't something that I particularly find myself when I read her. I mean, what's your sense of it, David? Would you call her a difficult writer? It seems strange to me that she has this reputation.
Well, I think that part of the problem is that difficulty has been characterized as a kind of literary ideology. I mean, we assume that the writers we call modernist set out to be difficult. And in elevating those writers into the canon, as happened in the second half of the 20th century, we've dignified difficulty. We've given it a very special status as something that the avant-garde uniquely brings to our experience of reading fiction or other forms of literature. And in a way, there's been a kind of spillage of the idea of difficulty onto her simply because she was around at the same time. But I think that's not true. I think that precisely the difficulty appears for a reason. It's there to trip us up, if you like. And yes, that is a sort of opacity. There is an amazing opacity to some of her sentences. And that opacity does bring us to a halt, but it's in order to make us reflect on what is actually happening at that time in the story. And once that effect has been produced, once we've been made to think, then on the whole, the narrative tends to resume its kind of even pace. And until we get to the next difficulty, the next surprise.
Yes, that's really interesting. You do get a sense that there's never a word wasted. Everything is there for a purpose. It's a well-made machine, as it were. But thinking about her reputation, I wanted to ask, I suppose, about or to touch on the merit of her novels relative to her stories. When you agreed to do the piece, David, you said you hoped to figure out in the course of writing it why you'd only ever half liked the novels. And that was something I'd felt too. I preferred the stories, and her reputation as a story writer does in some ways outflank her reputation as a novelist. But, you know, rereading them, how do they stand up, and what was your sense of the ways in which they differed from the stories?
Well, I think, like you, I expect, I first came to Bowen through her stories, and some of her stories are very, very widely anthologized. And I think, I mean, just speaking to people in general, they're more likely to know one of her stories than they are to know one of her novels. And I think that's something that's only, balance has only just sort of begun to be corrected a bit. And I thought, I suppose, in a way, once I'd established to my own satisfaction that she is a writer of place or place feeling or atmosphere, I began to think about the ways in which atmosphere appears or atmosphere is represented in the short stories as opposed to the novels. And in a way, atmosphere is at its purest in the short story. There is a kind of extraordinary kind of splash. And I'm thinking, I know there's a story that we both like, Summer Night, which starts with a woman driving through the Irish countryside and then into a small town in a car. And she's driving towards an assignation, towards a rendezvous with her lover. And it's a moment of intense excitement. I mean, the atmosphere is rendered over a couple of pages. And I have to say, I mean, it is very cinematic. And I always think at that point of Hitchcock, of the scene in Rebecca when Laurence Olivier and Joan Fontaine are approaching the stately house in an open-topped sports car, and it just begins to rain, and then you finally get a shot of the house through the windscreen. And in both the story and in the film, that's experience of approach is the most intense experience that the woman in both stories will actually feel. And there's an extraordinary way in which because it's the most tense, the extraordinary sense in which the story's actually already over in those opening pages, even though we don't know it until we get to the end, because nothing quite like it will ever happen to the protagonist again. So there is, you know, atmosphere flourishes. It's crucial to the stories. But what's different about the novels, and what in the end made me think that I actually prefer, that would more likely to be likely to reread the novels than the short stories, is that in the novels, atmospheres form, develop, intensify, and then exhaust themselves. And in that process, we understand that what at first looked like a mood, like a feeling projected by the protagonist, is in fact an environment shaped by forces beyond their individual control, but beyond the character's control. So what begins as looking like a mood ends up looking like a milieu, which is a much more complex structure. And that's, again, is the kind of Darwinian emphasis of Bowen's fiction, that there is no mood, there is no kind of purely personal sensation that isn't in some sense also a milieu, an environment, and thus shaped by forces beyond our control. And I think that's what the novels give you, that the short stories really, by their essence, can't.
And you write in the piece very interestingly that you say mood cannot outrun circumstance. And there's a way in which, you know, several of these characters, they kind of consider themselves rebels, but they're made hostages to fortune by circumstance. And, you know, and she was clearly, you know, incredibly imprisoned by, you know, her family history, the class into which she was born. But in a way, I suppose the novel gives, there's the scope to explore all the ways in which you're not free, that you need the length of the novel. You need the novel to run its course to kind of fully understand the extent to which these characters are sort of hemmed in, and maybe you don't get that as much in the stories.
I think the wonderful example of that is really in The Heat of the Day, which is the passionate affair between the heroine and Robert Kelway, so Stella and Robert. And that's a love affair, and love is the most intense of all moods. It's a mood intense enough to exclude absolutely everything else. But here it's associated from the outset with a very specific historical circumstance, namely September 1940, the Blitz, and it's a sweet autumn, Bowen says, for both of them. It's made sweet by their love for each other, but that sweetness also incorporates the taste and the smell of bomb damage, the dust rising from all these bomb sites the morning after, and so on. So already the mood is a milieu. And she puts it very explicitly, and this is what I think really what a novel does. And she says, the relation of people to one another is subject to the relation of each to time, to what is happening. So our most intimate relations to each other are also a relation to our time. And what happens in the novel is that this particular atmosphere, which is their love for each other, it too forms and develops and exhausts itself. And exhausts itself in a much more general mood or milieu, which is that of a kind of loss of collective faith in the period after the retreat from Dunkirk and the army that came back from Dunkirk, and which he called the raw black bitterness of the army returned from which is a loss of faith in the justice and the efficient conduct of the war. A war that at that point was still very much in the balance. And that raw black bitterness invades and destroys the relationship between the lovers.
And yes, that novel, I mean, she's a terrific historical novelist, in a way, a social novelist. And that novel, particularly her war novel, is really, really fascinating. I mean, you know, it's portrayal of London, you know, during the Blitz is frightening in some ways and, you know, incredibly atmospheric. But I was also interested in this idea in the piece that the new media that was on the rise during Bowen's lifetime influenced her work. And so she's also engaging with kind of technological innovations and things like that. And you quote her saying, you know, the modern life is telephone ridden. And I found that quite intriguing. And I wondered if you could say a little bit more really about the telephone as a social medium and about the ways in which she used it and the opportunities it created for her to engineer a particular kind of atmosphere or milieu for her characters.
Yeah, so I think your term engineer is exactly right, because in a way what she was interested in was the engineering of other kinds of atmosphere as demanded by what was happening in society and what people were feeling. So it's the engineering, and that's where media like the telephone or the radio come in. And I think what's interesting about her is that it's not so much what she has to say about a specific medium like the telephone or the radio, but her sense of new forms of experience, of what we would call connectivity, I think, as something which is beginning to shape people's lives, so that people begin to live through the telephone. It's the telephone as a social medium that really interests her most. And I think, to me, what's happening there and what's, again, makes her so modern is that she's beginning to move from the idea of atmosphere to the idea of atmospherics. That's to say, of disturbances of an electromagnetic origin which interfere with signals, which interfere with communication by electronic media. And I think she was the first novelist of what the media theorist Friedrich Kittler called the Olympian frequency domain, that there are all these frequencies from alpha to gamma which exist outside the scope of unaided human perception, but which can be used with the aid of machines either to communicate or to make stuff happen. And I think she was extraordinarily aware of that. And she thought of, so when she was thinking about radio, it was really radio as one of these kind of frequencies which exists beyond unaided human perception. And that's something that really becomes a focus of The Heat of the Day, again, in the character of Louis Lewis, who is a working class woman, works in a munitions factory. She's a war orphan, and she becomes obsessed with propaganda. The propaganda that she becomes in herself a kind of antidote to the raw black bitterness caused by Dunkirk, because she's this kind of exemplary figure, and she starts seeing herself, as it were, reflected and talked about in the newspapers. But there's always something beyond that, beyond the propaganda, and she begins to become fascinated by the heroine, Stella Rodney, and she begins to stalk her. And the more she gets to see and to know about Stella, the more she becomes convinced that there is something, as it were, beyond what the newspapers are telling us or beyond what the radio broadcasts are telling us. And that's really Bowen's fullest exploration of the Olympian frequency domain. And it's hard to think of any other writer at the time who was anything like as close to doing something like that.
Yes, and you write, you know, that this transitivity, this new media brought a kind of transitivity into being, which demanded a new kind of protagonist in some of her novels. So Theodora in Friends and Relations, but also Louis in The Heat of the Day, and that, you know, so many of the characters we've been talking about appear to suffer from a kind of lack of definition. But then there are these characters who appear to have a surplus of it, Louis being one of them. And you say, you know, this requires a virtual environment as though that could kind of refract it or mop up the surplus in some way. And so I suppose she's using the media as a way of doing that, of mopping up or refracting personality.
We always have to find new ways to shape ourselves or new ways to find shape. And that's really what social media offer. It's a new way to actually end the amorphousness, or it could be, if you like, or that's what it might look like, a new way to take shape. And that's why I think that she was able to sense the power. And I always think, I'll just go back to, there's one of the things she said about the experience of this relocation from Ireland to England, and the battery of aunts and being looked after by this kind of team of distant relatives. And she described it as a grapevine. She said that, you know, we were taken up by the grapevine of Anglo-Irish relatives who passed us from hand to hand. Now, the idea of the grapevine, it's already a communication system. So, you know, the kinship network is already a kind of WhatsApp group. She was thinking in those terms, and her experiences and her interest in the weird household, if you like, the interest in what you do when you find yourself in an outlandish situation. It was always, she was kind of predisposed to write about new media, I feel, about the Olympian frequency domain. And she ended up doing so. And I think that Louis Lewis is again, perhaps, you know, a really interesting example of one of the kind of those people with a surplus of personality who ends up straying, really, in her search for ways to kind of absorb it, soak it up, straying into what we would call the dark web.
Mm. And there's this intriguing observation towards the end of the piece that, you know, in some ways it's very interesting to reread Bowen now, in sort of the heyday of the internet novel, as it were, and you can imagine her as a kind of very strange progenitor to some of the writers. You know, I mean, you mentioned Lauren Euler, you mentioned Patricia Lockwood in the piece, but she was already thinking about networks and the way things go wrong and signals kind of get mixed up and the way that can be exploited or ruinous for people or by people. But I wondered if we might end, David, you reading a little bit from The Heat of the Day, a passage with Louis, about Louis, that sort of describes some of the stuff that we've been talking about and gives people a feel.
I think that would bring us right up to date, as it were. So, I mean, Louis, originally she finds that the mood and milieu to suit her in propaganda and newspapers and radio. And she's perfect for that. And that gives her a great sort of feeling of peace and contentment. And then she starts to stalk Stella. And she recognises Stella as a kind of soul in torment. And that recognition exposes a lack in the atmosphere that's been created for her and that's absorbed her, the atmosphere created by propaganda. And this is the description of how she begins to move, as it were, to edge into the dark web. Louis felt herself entered by what was foreign. She exclaimed in thought, "Oh no, I wouldn't be her," at the moment when she most nearly was. Think now what the air was charged with night and day. Ununderstandable languages, music you did not care for, sickness, germs. You did not know what you might not be tuning into. You could not say what you might not be picking up. Affected, infected you were at every turn. Receiver, conductor, carrier, which was Louis? What was she doomed to be? She asked herself, but without words. She felt what she had not felt before. Was it even she herself who was feeling?
Could almost have been written now. It's absolutely intriguing. Well, thank you so much, David, for speaking to me today and for writing this tremendous piece. And I hope everybody who hasn't already read it will do so immediately.
Thank you.
You can read David's piece in the latest issue of the paper, along with Patricia Lockwood's writing about Marianne Engels Bear, Come to Bean on the Life of Pessoa, and David Runciman on Michael Wolff's recent book about the last days of Trump's presidency.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.